We're going to get started. I'm Alex Ibanez. I'm the Research Operations Director at Merck & Company, and I'll be your MC for this breakout session. I am thrilled to be here to support the advancement of women leaders from across the state and in support of this community. Merck proudly works through our Global Diversity and Inclusion, our Women's Network, and all other EBRG's teams in recognizing and advancing women and women of color in the workplace. We're proud to be a partner of the Massachusetts Conference for Women. The Conferences for Women offer tools and inspiration to support you as you make your mark in, and for your companies, your careers, and your communities. Thank you for participating in the breakout session. Ask for it. Success for women begins with negotiating savvy. We have an amazing hour in store for you. Now, I am excited to introduce Sora Lashever. She has spent her career investigating the challenges that shape women's lives at work. She has co-authored Women Don't Ask, the groundbreaking study that focused public attention on the forces preventing women from negotiating on their own behalf, and Ask for It, how women can use the power of negotiation to get what they really want, a negotiation training primer for women trying to scale the barriers in their path. Sora lectures and teaches workshops to corporate audiences, colleges, universities, government agencies, and women's leadership conferences in the U.S. and around the world. She is frequently cited in the national and international media as an expert on women's leadership, the persistence of the wage gap, women and conflict resolution, and the multiple factors influencing women's long-term career success. Please welcome Sora Lashever.
Morning, everybody. So I want to start with a quick question. How many of you feel as though you're pretty good at negotiating on behalf of other people? Say on behalf of the people you supervise, your clients, your customers, your employers, your kids, your causes, right? Okay, just one more time, everybody's hands up. Okay, now put them down. How many of you think you are equally good at negotiating on behalf of yourself? Raise your hands. Four. Okay, so this is pretty common. Taking care of other people, advocacy is a gender norm for women, and we're pretty good at it. And so I want to remind you, you have the skills. You know how to do this well. But when it comes to asking for things for ourselves, we pull up short. So that's what we're going to talk about this morning. And we're going to start by talking about whether you really need to negotiate. A lot of women say, can't I avoid it? I'm not good at it. It makes me nervous. I'm afraid I'll embarrass myself or lose my composure. Can't I just sort of slide by? This is a meritocracy, right? I'll be rewarded appropriately for what I've done. Well, unfortunately, no. But one study showed that 20% of women say they never negotiate. And I think if they have kids, that's probably not completely true. But the statistic does point to an important fact about women, this constraint that holds us back. And I want to talk about another study quickly that illustrates this especially well. In this study, researchers asked both men and women whether they would rather negotiate a catering contract or listen to that horrible shrieking sound that nails make on a chalkboard. Only 8% of the women said they would negotiate the contract. Well, you know, like what all the men said, yeah, no brainer, sure, the contract, I hate that sound. So I understand why you avoid it. I think it's reasonable, but it's a bad choice, and you're sacrificing a lot when you don't negotiate. So let's just start with the money. One study showed that women who refrain from negotiating can sacrifice as much as $1 million over the course of their careers. And you may think, well, that's kind of an exaggeration, isn't it? That's a lot. But let me explain how that can work. Let's imagine we have a couple of young people starting out in their careers, a man and a woman, the man's in red, and they both start out making about the same amount. The man's making a little bit more because typically we do offer men a little bit more. We do resist when they try to negotiate a little bit less, but the starts of their careers, they're making about the same. for the next, whatever, 43 years, he negotiates all of his raises. He tries to push them up a little higher. And he averages 4.3% annual increases over the course of his career. She says, thank you so much, I'll take it, averages 2.9% increases. And of course, with each raise calculated as a percentage of what he or she was earning the year before, the gap between what they're making widens rapidly and dramatically. So by the time they're both ready to retire at 65, he's making over $100,000 more than she is making. And that's a nice extra chunk of change in your paycheck, but it's not $1 million. But you need to remember that he earned more every year that they both worked. And let's just say he took the difference, lived on kind of the original offer, took the difference, invested it in a low-earning retirement account, maybe only posting 3% annual increases. By the time they're both ready to retire, he's got a nice extra nest egg to enjoy his retirement with, or along the way, lots of extra money to do whatever he wants. And I could think of a lot of nice things a girl could do with all that money. Maybe buy a nice vacation home, send a couple kids to private colleges. I just have one who graduated, one who started, so I'm acutely aware of how expensive that can be. Maybe see the world if you like to travel, buy some expensive luxury goods. And I always like to pause when there are a couple of men in the room, because I had a weird experience when I showed this slide a few years ago, where a man came up to me afterwards, and I think he was serious. He had a great poker face, if not. And he said he was a little offended by this slide, and he hoped I was just talking about the car. And I took a close look at the slide. I was like, is that a man driving that car? I don't know about you. In my world, men are not luxuries, but I was talking about the car. Or, lastly, donate generously to the charity of your choice, or the charities. But as I said, women don't like to negotiate, and this is not just a hunch of mine, it's not just a conclusion I've drawn from the many, many interviews I've done with both men and women about this topic. I know because I wrote my books with a behavioral economist at Carnegie Mellon named Linda Babcock. And Linda did a lot of research studies trying to tease this apart, trying to figure out what was going on. She had people come into her lab and play games, and then waited to see who would ask for a larger payment than the other, because she'd advertised, oh, we'll pay $3 to $10, and gave everybody $3. Most of the men said, can I get 10? And most of the women said, thank you very much. She looked at outtake data from the Career Services Office at Carnegie Mellon to see who had negotiated their first job offer, men much more than women. She analyzed web data. She did a huge web survey, a lot of other studies. And regardless of methodology, she found that men were typically 4 times as likely to negotiate for something for themselves, so not for their employer, not for somebody else, but something that would help them get ahead, 4 times more frequently than women. So what that means is if every quarter, every 3 months or so, you get up your nerve and you steel yourself and you go in and ask for something that would be good for your career, the typical man is doing that 16 times a year. He may not be getting everything he's asking for, but simply because he is asking for so many more big and little things, he is pushing ahead. And just like with the money, the gap between what he's getting to do and the opportunities that are opening up and what you're getting to do is widening very rapidly. And I want to stress that I'm not just talking about money. I start with the money because it's so dramatic and it's very easy to quantify, but it's very clear, again from Linda's research, that it's not just money, where men are more likely than women to raise their hands and say, pick me, pick me, pick me. More likely to go knock on the door of the boss and say, I've done a lot in my current role, you know, I'm ready to move ahead, or what else have you got for me? More likely to ask for additional training when they think they can expand their skill sets in ways that would be rewarding and good for the company. More likely if they work in fields where referrals are necessary to build their practices. More likely to ask for referrals. More likely to ask to be nominated for powerful committee seats. More likely to ask for a whole lot of things that can help them get ahead, raise their visibility, and open doors for them. Women more likely to think, I'll just work really hard and do a great job. And there's a reason that we think this. I mean, there are, you know, a number of reasons, but one key interesting reason is that the culture of school has changed a lot in the last few decades. The culture of school now favors the ways in which women learn and work. So girls graduate from high school at a higher rate than boys do and higher in their classes. They go on to higher ed at higher rates. I think the demographics now are about 2-to-1 women to men. I think women make up about 60% of the college age population. They go on to master's degrees at higher rates, and the difference between men and women in even in PhD programs is widening. So girls, they're doing really well, and they think, okay, when I get into the work world, I know how to be successful. I'll just work really hard, do excellent work, and I will get whatever the equivalent is of an A or an A+. Unfortunately, the culture of work has not changed in the way the culture of school has changed. You really do need to hustle a little bit more. You do need to raise your hand. You do need to go knock on the door. And because women are so much less likely than men to do that, they often see men who are equally qualified to them, sometimes less qualified, advancing up the ladders of their professions and earning more money much more rapidly. But the negotiation piece isn't just important to get you into those leadership roles, to get you into roles where you are supervising others, where you have responsibility and authority. It's also, they're also important, these skills, to help you lead effectively. Right? We know that command and control doesn't work that well for women. For women, I would argue, good, effective, successful leadership depends in great part on negotiation skills. So you need to find out what other people want, offer to exchange your resources, support for getting them to weigh in support of your projects. You need to ask a lot of questions, find out what other people care about, what their goals are, what their strategy is, and then align yours with theirs. You need to ask for a lot of feedback from the people you supervise, a lot of input into the decisions that you make so that they feel that they have some ownership over those decisions and you can work with them more effectively. So really important as a leader, but it's also important if you supervise other women, because if you don't let them know, you need to ask me for what you need to be successful. You need to tell me what will help you be more productive. You may be mismanaging them. They may not be doing everything they're capable of. Similarly, if you're not asking them, what are your professional goals? Where do you want to go? You can't align what their, you know, next steps are with where you want them to go and get them to dovetail. You won't be able to manage them as effectively as possible. And then if you're in a client-facing role, you also need to know that women often won't ask for what they need or what they want from you. So I did some work with American Express financial advisors a few years ago, and these advisors, both men and women, said often we'll get couples coming in to get financial advice, and the men will say, well, these are our plans, these are our values, this is how we see our lives, you know, playing out, and this is what we want for retirement. If they don't ask the woman, they often won't discover that actually she has some different ideas, and she knows that women often outlive men, and she has some things she would like you to take into account when you are making plans for them and giving them advice. Another story, a woman I interviewed, she was a VP at a big cosmetics firm, so she had some money and she collected art. And she told me about this story where she had bought a piece of art from a gallery where she, you know, that she'd patronized before, and she took it home and she loved it. But she thought it was a little too expensive, so she took it back, you know, regretfully, and a month later the artist died. And she realized that piece was going to grow in value really rapidly now, and she went back to the gallery, and the gallery owner said, oh, it's gone. Why didn't you tell me how much you wanted it? I could have worked with you, figured out a payment plan, we could have, you know, made it happen if you had told me what you wanted, or, of course, if the gallery owner had said, you know, what are your feelings about this? Why are you bringing it back? Ask some questions. So, really important in a lot of realms of work. Of course, we also do a lot of negotiating outside work. We negotiate with service people, with contractors, with doctors, with caregivers who are looking after our elderly relatives or our kids. We negotiate with family members and hopefully our partners, although that's a different talk. But I want to just tell you a quick story to illustrate how maybe in all sorts of parts of your life you could think of asking, think of negotiating to remove some irritants, make things a little more convenient, just smooth the path ahead of you. So this is a story that Linda Babcock heard after our first book, Women Don't Ask, came out. And this, a friend of hers, a very successful woman, called her up and she said, it's so great that you've done this. I'm sure it's going to help a lot of people, but it's not really a problem I have. I'm really good at identifying what I want, going after it, and getting it. And Linda said, well, that's great. It's not very typical, but I'm really happy for you. And a couple months later, this woman and her male business partner went on a business trip to Houston. And they decided to stay in a new 5-star hotel that had just opened up and had been written up very favorably for its architecture and its restaurants. And they got in late and they met for breakfast the next morning. And this woman's male partner was raving about the hotel. Don't you think this place is gorgeous? I have the most beautiful view over the city. The bathroom is almost as big as my whole apartment in New York. Don't you think this is great? And Linda's friend said, well, that's all true, but I was kind of disappointed they didn't have one of those cushy spa robes in the closet like they usually have in luxury hotels. And her male partner looked kind of confused. And he said, well, they have robes. I just called housekeeping and asked for one. So this woman came back. She called Linda. She said, how many more things like that is a man going to say, excuse me, little help here, and a woman is just going to be disappointed, inconvenienced, whatever. So a few months later, this woman seems to have kind of a weird robe theme in her life. So she went on vacation with her kids, and they went to a Ritz-Carlton resort. As I said, she was very successful. And they did have robes in the closet for the adults, but they didn't have any for the kids. And her kids got kind of militant, she said. They were like, we want robes, we want robes. She was like, guys, they never have robes for the kids. But they wouldn't let up, so she said, okay, go ahead and call. So her kids called housekeeping. 5 minutes later, they brought 3 robes for the children to their hotel room. So I travel around a lot, teaching workshops, giving talks like this, and whenever I'm in a hotel, I think, they could afford to loan me a robe. Just for kicks, I always pick up the phone and call. I have never had them not bring me a robe, and sometimes they bring slippers, too. So something to think about as you go through your life. There might be some impediments, some disappointments, some inconveniences. So quick list of the things you sacrifice when you don't negotiate. I just want to point to the middle one that I highlighted, constraints on productivity and performance. If you are not using everything you've got, all your talents, or all your potential at work because you haven't raised your hand and say, I'm ready to do more, I can do more, I'm interested in doing more. If you are unhappy because you feel like you should have been promoted by now and you haven't been, you are going to be underperforming because, as we know, happy people are actually more productive than unhappy people. So it's not just a cost to you if you don't negotiate, it's actually a cost to organizations if they don't create a culture in which women are comfortable negotiating, encouraged to negotiate, and it's considered good management to help women do that so that they can get ahead. So let's talk just super briefly about causes. This is fascinating stuff, and if you're interested in the research, our first book, Women Don't Ask, has it, but I'm going to just kind of touch on it lightly. There are 3 major causes. The first one has to do with the socialization of children, what we teach little boys and little girls about how we expect them to behave as males and females in our culture. And we teach them a lot with the ways we talk to them and about them, with our behavior, what we role model. We teach them a lot with the television shows they watch, the books they read, the movies, also with the chores that we give them and the toys that we give them. The lessons are very, very profound, very overwhelming, and what they tell kids is we like girls to be good-natured and cheerful and compliant. We don't like pushy, grabby little girls. We don't like demanding, bossy little girls. We tell little boys, be a little tough guy, go out there, mix it up, get what you want for yourself. And so kids learn these lessons really early, really fast. One hilarious study showed that little boys in first grade, so we're talking about 6-year-olds, will raise their hands in class even when they don't know the answer to a question. In this case, of course, asking for the teacher's attention, and little girls will not raise their hands even when they do know the answer. They have already learned by the time they are 6 to wait to be recognized for their hard work and their brains and their accomplishments. So, socialization of children, next factor, the kinds of behavior we accept and tolerate in women as adults. It's very well established. We don't like women we perceive to be too aggressive, And both men and women, unfortunately, react negatively to women like that, and we punish them. We don't value their work accurately. We devalue it based on their style, their manner, rather than the objective quality of their work product. We don't include them in decision-making that can have a material impact on their future. We don't recommend them for those powerful committees, et cetera, et cetera. And, of course, we stigmatize them with ugly names. You know, high maintenance, difficult, not a team player. That one in the picture in the middle I don't need to say out loud. People usually get there before I do. And then the third factor has to do with networks. Women are typically either peripheral to or excluded completely from the social and professional networks in which men share a lot of information, give each other a lot of advice. They tell each other what's available, and they tell each other how to ask, who to ask, when to ask. They give each other information, because often people in charge are aware of opportunities, resources, big, you know, accounts, so, you know, high-profile clients, whatever. Committee seats, and they don't, you know, like send an email out to anybody who might be qualified or go and knock on the door of anyone who might be interested. They mention it to the people in their networks. And since the people in charge are often male, the people in their networks are also male, men just have a lot more information about what they could be asking for. And that's another reason they negotiate a lot more than women do. So the net result of these factors has been to produce very different feelings about negotiating for themselves in men and women. And a colleague of Linda's named Michelle Gelfand did this wonderful study that illustrated this. What she did was she asked men and women to identify words and metaphors that expressed how they felt about negotiating for themselves. Men chose words like fun and metaphors like winning a ball game. Women chose words like scary and metaphors like going to the dentist. So if you feel as though negotiating for yourself is a lot like having your teeth drilled, you might just rationalize not doing it. I hope I persuaded you that's not the right choice, and now we're going to talk about how to do it in ways that work for women. So let's just start with assuming that everything is negotiable. Everything is not negotiable, but so many more things are than we assume. It's a really great place to start. So I put these pictures up because they represent a study Linda did that we ended up calling the Oyster to Turnip Study. Because what she found is that men are much more likely than women to see the world as their oyster. They're surrounded by opportunities, chances, choices, resources, whatever, and they just need to figure out what they want and go and harvest those particular pearls. Women more likely to think you can't get blood from a turnip. What you see is what you get. You need to be a good sport or a good soldier and say thank you and be grateful for what you're offered. So don't be a turnip. Women 45% more likely than men to be turnips. So don't be a turnip. Assume everything is negotiable. Here is a list of some things that might be negotiable in your world. I can't be specific because I don't know enough about your personal circumstances. So I really just put this list up to prod your thinking about what you might negotiate in your situation that could help you be more productive, happier, whatever. I've highlighted the last two because they're, you know, one is credit for work accomplished. When women are parts of a team that does really good work, the women on the team usually get the least credit for the accomplishments of the team. So you need to make sure there is a record in your personnel file or in the narrative about the project of what your contributions were. And then there is negotiating evaluations or performance ratings that you don't think are fair. Men are much more likely to go in and say, I don't know if you realize that I did this, or this isn't a really accurate picture of what happened. And if you work in an organization or profession where performance ratings are numerical, again, there are studies that show even small differences in those performance ratings can contribute to men getting up into those higher level roles faster. So things to think about negotiating for. And then decide what you want. This may seem kind of obvious. I want to be promoted. I want to make more money. But what I want you to think about is, what do you really want? Not what you think you should want, what you think you can get, what's kind of straight in line ahead of where you are now. I encourage you to revisit this regularly and think about how your goals may have changed since you started your training or changed a job or returned to the workforce since you had kids. And, you know, think big or think you know, how your personal life has changed and how you want that to impact your life. So I've just put up, you know, some ideas. You work for a multinational, you'd like a foreign posting. You work in healthcare, you'd like to lead or be part of a humanitarian mission. You'd like to go back to school and get your MBA or get further training. You'd like your organization to send you to get that credential. You want to get into the room where it happens, where those critical decisions are made that aren't necessarily transparent to the rest of the organization. You really want to get up into the C-suite, or you'd like to get recognized early for your potential, your ambition, your talent, your ideas, your originality. What is it that you want? So think about it, and then drill down to very specific things you can ask for right now that are going to nudge you in the direction you want to go. A number of years ago, I taught a workshop at Credit Suisse, and a woman raised her hand at the end. She said, "Aren't you worried people are going to get asking fatigue if I'm just asking for stuff all the time?" And that's actually not what I'm suggesting. I want you to ask strategically for the things that are going to get you where you want to go. Okay? And then do your research. This may be the single most important piece of advice I'm going to give you today. People don't plan to fail, they fail to plan. Old truism. With negotiation, that is particularly true. Most of what happens when you get into that room, when you get into that conversation, will be determined by how well you prepare in advance. So do your research. Find out what other people, something weird's happening here, what other people like you are getting, what they're asking for, not just financially, what they're being offered, not just financially, but in terms of opportunities, next steps, resources, support. And not just in your current organization, but at peer or competitor organizations or in allied fields where your skills might be marketable. And I want to emphasize, apples to apples doesn't mean just comparing yourself to other women. Often when you get into upper levels, there aren't as many women, but women are more likely to compare themselves to other women who may, in fact, not have risen quite as high. You need to also think about men who are, you know, who are at your level and find out what they're asking for, what they're being offered, and what they're getting. And then get on the web. There are tons of information on the web. Salary.com, Glassdoor, Payscale. The Bureau of Labor Statistics has a tremendous amount of data that is broken down by race and gender and other smaller categories. But there are also obviously lots of job search sites that have more information than just, you know, this job is available. Information, say, whether there are not many people with your skills in the area or the region where you live or where you're thinking of moving, or go to the professional associations that that you're members of. They usually have women's pages or information about the challenges women face in the profession, that kind of thing. Lots and lots of data on the web. Be resourceful, do some Googling, and then talk to your social and professional networks. This is something people often hesitate to do. Usually people are flattered to be asked. You don't necessarily have to say, "What do you make?" It's kind of awkward. But you could say, "I really admire your career. Would you be willing to talk about, you know, crucial decisions, things you asked for that helped you get where you are?" Or, "This is where I am, that's where I want to go. Can you give me some advice about how to get from here to there?" Not only do you get their advice in the moment, but they then may feel a little bit more invested in your career. And if they hear about something you might be interested in, they might send you an email. Or if they hear about something you might be good at, they might bring up your name or recommend you. So talk to your social and professional networks, but be sure to talk to men as well as women. Because if you're just talking to women and you're talking about salary in particular, you can be talking to people who think you can only get about 80% of what is really possible, because that's the wage gap. So if you're talking to women, you're going to be talking to people who may have a depressed, inaccurate sense of what you can get. There's another piece to this, which is that I'm sure you've heard some of this data. Men are more likely to think about what they might do next in terms of their potential. So they will apply for a job if they have 60% of the qualifications listed on the job posting. Women are likely to think about what they can do next in terms of what they've already proven conclusively they can do. So women won't apply unless they have 95% of the qualifications listed on the job posting. So if you go to another woman and say, I'm thinking of doing this, it's kind of a stretch for me, what do you think? Without any failure of sisterhood or wish to hold you back, but thinking about you the same way she thinks about herself, she might say, so tell me what's on your CV again? Whereas if you ask a man, again, thinking about you the same way he thinks about himself, he might say, you should totally go for that. You would be great at that. So talk to men as well as women. And then you're planning, you know, this is kind of a high-stakes negotiation, an important negotiation. You're preparing thoroughly. Where can you do what I call the ground-level intel gathering? So I'm a big fan of making friends with the executive assistants, the administrators, the people who work for people in power. They often know a great deal about whatever idiosyncratic deals that have been made in the past, about the history, also about how the person, you know, likes to be asked, what works well. There's a famous story of this woman named Lily Ledbetter. And Lily was, there was some legislation named after her eventually, but she worked as a manager at Goodyear Tire in Georgia for something like 30 years. Very good, great evaluations, very popular. And she only discovered that she had consistently been paid less than her male peers because somebody left her an anonymous note. And I'm convinced it was that lady in the pink sweater. I'm convinced it was somebody who worked for somebody in power who saw this paperwork going across her desk year after year, and it made her nuts. So make friends with those people. Make friends with the people in the social networks, the people that your boss, supervisors, that they, you know, whatever, play sports with, socialize with outside of work. And don't overlook the people who are always up on the latest gossip. They often have a lot of information about what's going on that can be really useful. Okay? So the next thing you need to do is think about what you bring to the table. This we call your value proposition. And what you bring to the table is not what's on your CV. It's what makes you particularly qualified, what makes you special, what will help you be successful at what you are asking to do. So you pioneered a similar initiative at your previous job, or you have a particular connection to the demographic that will be targeted by this initiative, or you have a passion for the subject, the meat of whatever it is. What about your experience and your personality, your interests, your values makes you really qualified to be good at it? And this is really important. You need to make the argument that letting you do this thing that you're really good at will be good for the other side. Women in particular need to make what we call a relational argument. If you give me what I'm asking for, it will help advance your objectives, your performance targets, this long-term strategy, the goals of the department, the group, the division, the company. Giving me what I'm asking for will be good for you. And that's where you talk about, this is all the value I am bringing to the company, okay? Value proposition. And then decide what to ask for. This is different from what you want, okay? You want to ask for a little bit more than you want because they will probably negotiate with you, and so you want space to negotiate down to what you really want. And most negotiations are not just about one thing. They're not just about salary. They're about titles. They're about responsibilities. They're about timing. They're about who you're going to supervise. They're about all sorts of other things. And, you know, vacation time, flex time, whatever. They can be about a lot of things, so you need to think about all those things, what's most important, what you would like, throw in a few things that would be great but would be easy to give up in a trade, and then rank them in order of priority. This is non-negotiable. I have to get this, or I'm going to take that other job that, you know, somebody, some headhunter called me about. This I could give up. And I mean, I recommend actually writing it down, and taking it with you into the negotiation. So in the heat of the moment, you don't agree to things that when you were calm and you were planning, you had decided would not be good enough, Okay. It's a dry day. The next thing you want to do is choose your tactics. There are two basic approaches to negotiation. One is more competitive, more adversarial. I'm going to win, you're going to lose, I'm going to get more, and therefore you will get less. This is what we call a zero-sum negotiation. And if you're just talking about money, it is true that if you get more, they'll have less, and vice versa. But as I said, most negotiations are about more than one thing. And then a more collaborative problem-solving approach. What are your needs? What are your goals? This is what I'm hoping for. I have these constraints, but I have some flexibility here. Collaborative problem-solving. We're on the same side. We want to walk out of this room where both of our situations are improved. Let's talk about it. And women tend to be very good at that more collaborative problem-solving kind of negotiation. Good at sort of getting down to business. Okay, so what's going on here? What do you need? This is my situation. Let's find a good solution. Men are more likely to go to the adversarial, more competitive approach, which decades of negotiation research have shown actually produces inferior agreements for both sides. So if you can pull somebody who is taking that more combative approach over to let's talk about it, let's solve these problems, let's brainstorm together, that's great. But as you're going in, hopefully you have a sense of how this person is going to approach it, and you can tailor your approach and your prep accordingly. And then there's, the psychological prep piece. As I said, a lot of women feel anxious. They are afraid they will lose their tempers or lose their composure, burst into tears. Perfectly reasonable to have strong feelings, strong emotions about the negotiation if the stakes are high, if it's important to you, but really not a good tactic to take those emotions into the negotiation. So here are a number of things you can do to manage that part of it, manage the behavioral part of it. First of all, go get some training. Go to an executive ed program. If you live in the Boston area, you're in luck. The Harvard Program on Negotiation is the International Nerve Center of Negotiation Studies. And they have a lot of exec ed programs, as does the Kennedy School, as does the Sloan School at MIT. Simmons has a lot of programs really focused on women. If you live elsewhere in the state, there are other business schools, and most of them will have this kind of executive ed program. There's a lot to be gained from going and negotiating a lot of different scenarios over 12 or 13 weeks with a lot of different people. If that isn't possible, or you'd rather work through a book, Linda and I wrote our second book, Ask For It, because we did get a lot of feedback from women saying, yeah, I have this problem, tell me what to do about it. So Ask For It is more of a self-training manual. People will sometimes work through it together with, a buddy or in a book club. But there are a lot of great books. Choose the one if you want to go to a book that suits your learning style and you feel will be the most helpful. And then get together with a friend. Let me just say about the practice piece before I move on. It's not just that you'll get better at it. You'll feel more confident. You'll feel more settled going into the negotiation. So, combat anxiety. Get together with a friend or a colleague that you trust. Brief them thoroughly about the negotiation and about what you're worried about. And then play it through several times. Get them to really push your buttons, make you mad, insult you, embarrass you, hurt your feelings, whatever it is you're worried about. And then practice calm responses that move things away from conflict, that move things away from that more adversarial tone towards the joint problem solving that works so much better. So you're worried that if you aim high, which I recommend, let me just pause for a moment around targets, there's a direct correlation between the target or your goal going into a negotiation and what you get. Men tend to set targets that are about 30% higher than those women set. And one study showed that if you aim 30% higher, you have a pretty good chance of getting 10% more. And as we'll recall, model at the beginning of the talk, those little amounts can add up over time. So aim high, but if you're worried about aiming high, they're going to go, oh, that's crazy, you're ridiculous, that's absurd. Don't aim, lower, but practice in your role play saying, okay, we're really far apart, how close can you come? Or what would seem more appropriate to you? Tell me why you don't feel as though that's possible. Get them to talk to you, share their information, talk about what their problems and constraints are. They may be proceeding according to a misunderstanding that you can clear up. Or they may have a little roadblock or a problem that you can help them solve. Or they might not be able to give you what you want now, but they could in 6 months or a year, and you could get them to commit to it now. Plus, you're asking them questions, you're drawing them out, you're expressing interest in what their problems are, and that builds a sense of alliance and trust. All right? So play it through a lot of times. Practice those calm responses. This has a double benefit. Not only do you know what you want to do if the thing you're afraid of happens, but if it happens, triggering the emotion you were worried about, the emotion won't surprise you because you will have already experienced it in the role play. And it turns out that it is the surprise, even more than the feeling itself, that tends to derail us. We're like, oh, I'm upset, and we want to get out of the room because we feel vulnerable. And so we take whatever's on the table and we say, okay. But if you've had the emotion triggered in your role play, it's much easier to say to yourself, yeah, that makes me mad, and then keep going with your plan. So I strongly recommend the role playing. And then there's the behavioral piece that I really like the most, which is get yourself in a good mood. You can imagine that if you go into a negotiation right after having had a fight with your partner or your kid, you know, getting on the bus in the morning, or you get stuck in bad traffic and you're really irritated, or you fly in for an interview and they lose your luggage and you go in a bad mood, negative emotions are contagious. You'll get into a kind of a tense conflict spiral with the other person. The good news is that positive moods are also contagious. So if you can get yourself into a cheerful, upbeat frame of mind, the other person will mirror that back and you will get to a more creative space and probably get a better outcome. So if endorphins are your friend, see if you can plan your negotiation so you can go for a run beforehand or maybe a swim, or maybe you could take a break at lunch and do some yoga or meditate. A lot of people find that that can be very calming and centering. Other people have told me that pouring a complex piece of classical music or a really joyful piece of popular music into their heads right before they walk into the room can make them, you know, feel a little bit lighter, a little bit more cheerful. Or have lunch with the people who make you feel like the most hilarious, charming person in the world, but don't have a drink. And then it's time to, you know, one of the big day dawns, it's time to go in there and put it all together. And the first thing, and this is so critical for women, is set the right tone. This is not the right tone. Do not go in guns blazing. All right, I'm ready, I'm prepared, and this is what I'm going to tell you, this is what I need. When you come off as aggressive, when you come off as demanding, people are more likely to push back. And of course, we know that behavior that seems too aggressive in a woman would go unremarked in a man, but tone, really important. Make warm eye contact. Use relaxed, open body language. Shake hands. Speak, if you can, after practicing, in a relaxed, upbeat tone of voice. For women, the style, the way in which you ask, is enormously important. And people will push back. Whenever I give a talk like that, someone will say, well, isn't that a big step backwards? Why should I have to work so hard to make sure the other people in the room are having a good time? And I agree. I think it is dumb. I think it is an extra burden on women to have to be so careful about the interpersonal dynamics. Men can sort of put their argument, put their proposal on the table. These are the facts. This is what I bring to the situation. This is what I want. And people can kind of hear the justice of the proposal kind of more objectively. A woman needs to also seem likable. And I think there's a whole other session that's on likability. Need to come off to be influential or persuasive. Very clear from the research, women often also need to abide by our normative expectation that women will be kind of social and warm and you know, other focused. You need to seem likable. Now, if you don't feel like that's something you want to do, I respect that. If you're like, I'm going in there as me and, you know, I'm going to make my argument and hopefully they'll accept it. But I put it out there for your consideration because it has been shown to allow women to go a few more rounds, aim a little higher, and come away with better agreements. And if you do that, maybe you can get up into the upper levels of your organization or your profession, and then you'll be in a position to change the culture in ways that make it possible for women to ask in any old way that suits their personalities. The next thing I want to recommend is building affiliation with the person you're negotiating with. So there's a phenomenon called homophily, which describes the fact that people like to associate with, they like to socialize with, they like to do business with people who are like them. So men are more likely to want to promote other men, men who are from their class, went to school with them, have, you know, whatever, play the same sport, whatever it is. You are not a man. Maybe one or two of you are. But so what you need to do, you're automatically not like them. So anything you can do to signal that actually you have things in common will create a greater sense of alliance and make you seem more similar. So say you know that the boss has a whatever annual subscription to the symphony you played in, you know, your school orchestra. See if you can talk about classical music. Sports. If you can talk about sports, men sustain a lot of superficial but useful friendships, alliances by talking about sports. If you could talk about sports, particularly in Massachusetts, talk about sports. If you're a gamer and you know he's a gamer, if he's really into gadgets, you just got the new Apple Watch, whatever it is you know he's interested in. Your kid plays soccer, his kid plays soccer, he collects classic cars, you once saw a classic car, whatever. See what you can talk about. And of course, you can do this even before you get in the room, you know, create the sense that you're similar. And then justify your request. Any data you provide to support what you're asking for increases the odds that you'll get much of what you're asking for, what you're looking for. Ask questions. This is the negotiating super skill. Ask questions. Draw them out. Find out what's going on the other side of the table. Don't let yourself be rushed. It's very tempting, especially if the situation feels kind of fraught, to say, okay, great, thanks, and get out of there. People who take their time tend to exchange more information, learn more about what both sides are looking for, come away with better agreements. If you're afraid that they're going to yank the offer, though, and you still want it, even though that, you know, threat is hanging over you, of course, agree then. But if you can slow down, ask questions, if something has happened in the negotiation that you didn't expect that kind of changes the picture, it's actually okay to say, this has been great. Can we just take a little break and, regroup in 15 minutes, 2 hours, next week, whatever seems doable, and then go back to your desk, make a few phone calls, get on the web, decide how you want to handle this new information. But you do need to be prepared, having formulated that list, what you have to get to make it work, you have to be prepared that sometimes you are going to have to walk away. And then it's really good to have thought about what your options are, what you could get or do for yourself if you reach an impasse. Hopefully that will not be the case and you will reach a great agreement. When you do, confirm it in writing. In negotiation classes, we'll often have, you know, students do a practice negotiation, send them home to write up what they think they agreed to. And you would be surprised at how often what they think they agreed to is not the same. So follow up in writing, send an email. If they say, oh, no, that's not what I meant, go a couple rounds until you get absolute written concrete agreement, a confirmation of what the agreement was. All right. Lastly, if you never hear no, so I have two boys, and when they were little, they used to play Little League. And Little League coaches will tell kids, if you never get thrown out stealing a base, you're not trying to steal enough bases. So if you never hear no, you are not testing what's possible, you're not testing what you're capable of, you're not looking for the limits, and you're not aiming high enough. You're not asking enough, that is frequently enough, but you're not asking for enough when you do ask. So don't be so afraid of no. And so I want to just let Meryl Streep end for me because she does this so well. And then we will have a few minutes for questions.
It's amazing how much you can get if you quietly, clearly, and authoritatively demand it. That's all.
So did everybody hear that? It was a little soft. Everybody in the back heard it. How much you can get if you quietly, clearly, and authoritatively demand it. And what I want to point out is that's something fairly strong that she's saying, but she says it in such a charming way that you feel like, absolutely, Meryl, anything you want. So this is just to emphasize how you ask is really important for women. So there we go. So this is sort of a bulleted list of all the kind of high points of what I've been talking about. I don't think there are handouts, so take a picture. All right, and then some books I recommend, in particular, Getting to Yes is the classic. If you have not read Getting to Yes, everybody needs to read Getting to Yes. If you're particularly worried about getting emotional, about how your internal whatever disruptions might influence the negotiation beyond reason is fascinating. Talking to 9 to 5 is a classic, but really useful. Influence. Lots of little behavioral things you can do to nudge things in the right direction. So, so interesting. And then lastly, this is how you can reach me. Thank you very much. I will be signing books later, but we have time, about 10 minutes for questions, and I see some people are lined up. So, thank you.
Thank you for your amazing our amazing speaker for the insights and expertise presented today. We're going to give the audience a chance to ask questions, but before you go to the mics, I would like to ask the very first question. If you could give the attendees one marching order, one actionable tip they can easily implement when they leave today as it relates to success for women begins with negotiation savvy, what would that be?
Goals. Think about what you really want. Start from there and figure out how to ask, what to ask from there. But really, women are often like, this is what I ought to do, these are the shoulds. Think about what you really want. And that could be, I want to go home and raise my kids. Whatever it is, I think feminism is about women getting to choose. So figure out what you want and then go from there.
Thank you. Now we're thrilled to open the discussion to you and the audience. Please line up and we'll take turns. Start on this side.
Yeah.
Yeah, hi, thank you so much. My name's Rebecca. I wanted to know your thoughts on organizations where, like, there is no room for negotiation. For example, I've been in situations where I don't even have the opportunity to ask. I set up the meeting and the first thing out of their mouth is, you're not getting a raise, like, that's not happening. Mm. You know, and I've done some of the research and similar peers have had the same experience, and I'm curious what your thoughts are in those situations.
Well, so there are organizations, nonprofits quite typically, some other, where there's a level, and that's all they're going to pay. But that doesn't mean you can't negotiate for anything else. They could help you maybe bump yourself up to the next level, or, you know, get your work to be more interesting, do something else that will expand your skill set. So think about what else you could ask for that might make you more valuable and that will then, you know, put you into a different whatever category. The other thing I would say is think about changing jobs. If you really feel stymied and you can't move, then maybe it's time to look somewhere else.
Thank you.
Right here in the middle.
Yes, hi. Thank you for all the work that you do. My question is about a promotion I recently negotiated. We were still very far apart, and then I was told I would get a small raise about 3 months ago. Mm. Even though we've talked about it 3 times, this raise has still not come about. Mm. And at what point do you go to the skip level to start to talk about this? And also on the heels of this, I found out that I'm tremendously underpaid compared to my male counterparts.
Okay, so a couple of things. So remember I said confirm it in writing? So I have a story in one of the books of a woman who got up her nerve, went, negotiated, got a raise confirmed, and then went back to her desk, and it wasn't showing up, and she realized she had not gotten a commitment to the date it was going to start. So 3 months now is the time to go in and say, when is this going to start? And if whoever it is blocking you, is, you know, immovable, then it's time to move ahead. If you're in an organization that is where women are typically paid a lot less, I would go to HR and ask them, what are the policies about parity in this organization? And on my website and also in Ask For It, I have a fairness assessment survey with a lot of questions you could ask about your organization and actually, you know, ask your organization about what their policies are. And if they do not have any commitment to parity, again, it might be time to get another job.
Thank you.
Thank you. On this end?
Hi. So I happen to have a female manager, mm-hmm. and when negotiating with her last year, the conversation kind of took a turn to her career. So how do you redirect? Like she was saying, it took me X number of years to get here, X number, but I'm keep saying I'm not you. I'm, you know, doing things differently than you did. Mm-hmm. And I just don't know how to redirect the conversation because she tends to get off topic.
So basically she was saying, I can't give you more, move you ahead faster because I didn't get to move ahead faster. So there is a generational disconnect around that. I think especially older boomers who, you know, the women, they really had to fight so hard and we can feel sympathy for them. It was really difficult for them to get where they are. But, you know, times have changed. And I guess the question is, do you think you could say to her, you know, times have changed, I'm doing a lot more. I think I have a lot of value to bring to those other roles, that I'm doing a lot here, but I could do more that would make you look good. You know, this is, you know, this isn't just about what I want, it's about what's good for the organization. You may need to go to a, you know, a male peer, maybe at her level, and say, can you give me some advice about how to make this happen? Because professionally, and that's another thing you can say to her, it's just professional. It's not about me being male or female. This is the obvious next step, and I'm ready for it. I hope that's helpful.
We have time for one more question. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for being here. My name is Allie. Yeah. And earlier you mentioned the importance of asking questions, so I would love for you to elaborate on what type of questions and specifically what question or check-in you should ask after you've proposed what you feel you deserve, because the only one that comes to my mind is, so what do you think? And I don't feel that that is strong.
Well, so you made a strong proposal. This is the value I bring. This is why I think this will be great for you. And you can say, so I'd like to hear about what's going on your side of the table. Pretty general question. How does this align with your goals, your strategy, your performance targets? My understanding of where the group is going or the department is X, and it seems to me that what I'm asking for will promote those goals. Have I misunderstood anything? In Ask For It, our second book, a shameless self-promotion, but we have a lot of language that you can use in a lot of different circumstances that you can maybe adapt to, you know, to your situation.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, we would like to thank all of you for coming over and spending some time here. Thank you so much, Sarah, for coming.